The Celtic Twilight, Fairy and Folklore by William Butler Yeats. An Adult Brain audiobook production read to you by Monica Perez.
The Hosting of the She. The host is riding from Knocknarea and over the grave of Cluthnabhair. Quilcha tossing his burning hair, and Neve calling, "Away, come away. Empty your heart of its mortal dream. The winds awaken, the leaves whirl round. Our cheeks are pale, our hair is unbound. Our breasts are heaving, our eyes are agleam. Our arms are waving, our lips are apart. And if any gaze on our rushing band, we come between him and the deed of his hand. We come between him and the hope of his heart. The host is rushing twixt night and day, and where is there hope or deed as fair?" Quilcha tossing his burning hair, and Neve calling, "Away, come away." This book. I have desired, like every artist, to create a little world out of the beautiful, pleasant, and significant things of this marred and clumsy world, and to show in a vision something of the face of Ireland to any of my own people who would look where I bid them. I have therefore written down accurately and candidly much that I have heard and seen, and, except by way of commentary, nothing that I have merely imagined. I have, however, been at no pains to separate my own beliefs from those of the peasantry, but have rather let my men and women, duels and fairies, go their way unoffended or defended by any argument of mine. The things a man has heard and seen are threads of life, and if he pull them carefully from the confused distaff of memory, any who will can weave them into whatever garments of belief please them best. I too have woven my garments like another, but I shall try to keep warm in it, and shall be well content if it do not unbecome me. Hope and Memory have one daughter, and her name is Art, and she has built her dwelling far from the desperate field where men hang out their garments upon forked boughs to be banners of battle. O beloved daughter of Hope and Memory, be with me for a little. I have added a few more chapters in the manner of the old ones, and would have added others, but one loses, as one grows older, something of the lightness of one's dreams. One begins to take life up in both hands, and to care more for the fruit than the flower, and that is no great loss, perhaps. In these new chapters, as in the old ones, I have invented nothing but my comments and one or two deceitful sentences that may keep some poor storyteller's commerce with the devil and his angels, or the like, from being known among his neighbors. I shall publish in a little while a big book about the Commonwealth of Faery, and shall try to make it systematical and learned enough to buy pardon for this handful of dreams. A Teller of Tales. Many of the tales in this book were told me by one Paddy Flynn, a little bright-eyed old man who lived in a leaky and one-roomed cabin in the village of Ballisadare, which is, he was wont to say, the most gentle, whereby he meant fairy, place in the whole of County Sligo. Others hold it, however, but second to Drumcliff and Drumahair. The first time I saw him, he was cooking mushrooms for himself. The next time, he was asleep under a hedge, smiling in his sleep. He was indeed always cheerful, though I thought I could see in his eyes, swift as the eyes of a rabbit, when they peered out of their wrinkled holes, a melancholy which was well nigh a portion of their joy, the visionary melancholy of purely instinctive natures and of all animals. And yet there was much in his life to depress him, for in the triple solitude of age, eccentricity, and deafness, he went about much pestered by children. It was for this very reason, perhaps, that he ever recommended mirth and hopefulness. He was fond, for instance, of telling how Columbkill cheered up his mother. "How are you today, mother?" said the saint. "Worse," replied the mother. "May you be worse tomorrow," said the saint. The next day, Columbkill came again, and exactly the same conversation took place. But the third day, the mother said, "Better, thank God," and the saint replied, "May you be better tomorrow." He was fond, too, of telling how the judge smiles at the last day alike when he rewards the good and condemns the lost to unceasing flames. He had many strange sights to keep him cheerful or to make him sad. I asked him, had he ever seen the fairies, and got the reply, "Am I not annoyed with them?" I asked, too, if he had ever seen the banshee. "I have seen it," he said, "down there by the water, batting the river with its hands." I have copied this account of Paddy Flynn with a few verbal alterations from a notebook which I almost filled with his tales and sayings shortly after seeing him. I look now at the notebook regretfully, for the blank pages at the end will never be filled up. Paddy Flynn is dead. A friend of mine gave him a large bottle of whiskey, and though a sober man at most times, the sight of so much liquor filled him with a great enthusiasm, and he lived upon it for some days and then died. His body, worn out with old age and hard times, could not bear the drink as in his young days. He was a great teller of tales, and unlike our common romancers, knew how to empty heaven, hell, and purgatory, fairyland, and earth to people his stories. He did not live in a shrunken world, but knew of no less ample circumstance than did Homer himself. Perhaps the Gaelic people shall, by his like, bring back again the ancient simplicity and amplitude of imagination. What is literature but the expression of moods by the vehicle of symbol and incident? And are there not moods which need heaven, hell, purgatory, and fairyland for their expression, no less than this dilapidated earth? Nay, are there not moods which shall find no expression unless there be men who dare to mix heaven, hell, purgatory, and fairyland together, or even to set the heads of beasts to the bodies of men, or to thrust the souls of men into the heart of rocks? Let us go forth, the teller of tales, and seize whatever prey the heart long for, and have no fear. Everything exists, everything is true, and the earth is only a little dust under our feet. Belief and unbelief. There are some doubters even in the Western villages. One woman told me last Christmas that she did not believe either in hell or in ghosts. Hell, she thought, was merely an invention got up by the priest to keep people good. And ghosts would not be permitted, she held, to go traipsing about the earth at their own free will. But there are fairies, she added, and little leprechauns and water horses and fallen angels. I have met also a man with a Mohawk Indian tattooed upon his arm who held exactly similar beliefs and unbeliefs. No matter what one doubts, one never doubts the fairies. For as the man with the Mohawk Indian on his arm said to me, they stand to reason. Even the official mind does not escape this faith. A little girl who was at service in the village of Grange, close under the Seward slopes of Ben Bulbin, suddenly disappeared one night about 3 years ago. There was at once great excitement in the neighborhood because it was rumored that the fairies had taken her. A villager was said to have long struggled to hold her from them, but at last they prevailed, and he found nothing in his hands but a broomstick. The local constable was applied to, and he at once instituted a house-to-house search, and at the same time advised the people to burn all the buckalawns, the ragweed, on the field she vanished from, because buckalawns are sacred to the fairies. They spent the whole night burning them, the constable repeating spells the while. In the morning, the little girl was found, the story goes, wandering in the field. She said the fairies had taken her away a great distance, riding on a fairy horse. At last, she saw a big river, and the man who had tried to keep her from being carried off was drifting down it. Such are the topsy-turvydoms of fairy glamour. In a cockle shell. On the way, her companions had mentioned the names of several people who were about to die shortly in the village. Perhaps the constable was right. It is better, doubtless, to believe much unreason and a little truth than to deny for denial's sake truth and unreason alike. For when we do this, we have not even a rush candle to guide our steps, not even a poor salth to dance before us on the marsh, and must needs fumble our way into the great emptiness where dwell the misshapen duels. And after all, can we come to so great evil if we keep a little fire on our hearths and in our souls and welcome with open hand whatever of excellent come to warm itself, whether it be man or phantom, and do not say too fiercely, even to the jewels themselves, be ye gone? When all is said and done, How do we not know but that our own unreason may be better than another's truth? For it has been warmed on our hearths and in our souls, and is ready for the wild bees of truth to hive in it and make their sweet honey. Come into the world again, wild bees. Mortal help. One hears in the old poems of men taken away to help the gods in a battle. And Cuchulainn won the goddess Fand for a while by helping her married sister and her sister's husband to overthrow another nation of the Land of Promise. I have been told, too, that the people of Faerie can't even play at hurley unless they have on either side some mortal whose body or whatever has been put in its place, as the storyteller would say, is asleep at home. Without mortal help, they are shadowy and cannot even strike the balls. One day, I was walking over some marshy land in Galway with a friend when we found an old, hard-featured man digging a ditch. My friend had heard that this man had seen a wonderful sight of some kind, and at last we got the story out of him. When he was a boy, he was working one day with about 30 men and women and boys. They were beyond Chum and not far from Knocknagar. Presently, they saw all 30 of them, and at a distance of about half a mile, some 150 of the people of Faerie. There were two of them, he said, in dark clothes like people of our own time, who stood about 100 yards from one another. But the others wore clothes of all colors, bracket or checkered, and some with red waistcoats. He could not see what they were doing, but all might have been playing hurley, for they looked as if it was that. Sometimes they would vanish, and then he would almost swear they came back out of the bodies of the two men in dark clothes. These two men were of the size of living men, but the others were small. He saw them for about half an hour, and then the old man he and those about him were working for took up a whip and said, get on, or we will have no work done. I asked if he saw the fairies too. Oh, yes, but he did not want work he was paying wages for to be neglected. He made everybody work so hard that nobody saw what happened to the fairies. A visionary. A young man came to see me at my lodgings the other night and began to talk of the making of the earth and the heavens and much else. I questioned him about his life and his doings. He had written many poems and painted many mystical designs since we met last, but latterly had neither written nor painted, for his whole heart was set upon making his mind strong, vigorous, and calm, and the emotional life of the artist was bad for him, he feared. He recited his poems readily, however. He had them all in his memory. Some, indeed, had never been written down. They, with their wild music, as of winds blowing in the reeds, seemed to me the very inmost voice of Celtic sadness and of Celtic longing for infinite things the world has never seen. Suddenly, it seemed to me that he was peering about him a little eagerly. "Do you see anything, Xavier?" I said. "A shining winged woman covered by her long hair is standing near the doorway," he answered, or some such words. "It is the influence of some living person who thinks of us and whose thoughts appear to us in that symbolic form." Is it the influence of some living person who thinks of us and whose thoughts appear to us in that symbolic form, I said? For I am well instructed in the ways of the visionaries and in the fashion of their speech. "No," he replied, "for if it were the thoughts of a person who is alive, I should feel the living influence in my living body, and my heart would beat and my breath would fail. It is a spirit. It is someone who is dead or who has never lived." I asked what he was doing and found he was clerk in a large shop. His pleasure, however, was to wander about upon the hills, talking to half-mad and visionary peasants or to persuade queer and conscience-stricken persons to deliver up the keeping of their troubles into his care. Another night, when I was with him in his own lodging, more than one turned up to talk over their beliefs and disbeliefs and sun them as if it were in the subtle light of his mind. Sometimes visions come to him as he talks with them, and he is rumored to have told diverse people true matters of their past days and distant friends and left them hushed with dread of their strange teacher who seems scarce more than a boy and is so much more subtle than the oldest among them. The poetry he recited me was full of his nature and his visions. Sometimes it told of other lives he believes himself to have lived in other centuries, sometimes of people he had talked to, revealing them to their own minds. I told him I would write an article upon him, and it, and was told in turn that I might do so if I did not mention his name, for he wished to be always unknown, obscure, impersonal. Next day, a bundle of his poems arrived, and with them a note in these words. Here are copies of verses you said you liked. I do not think I could ever write or paint anymore. I prepare myself for a cycle of other activities in some other life. I will make rigid my roots and branches. It is not now my turn to burst into leaves and flowers. The poems were all endeavors to capture some high, impalpable mood in a net of obscure images. There were fine passages in all, but these were often embedded in thoughts which have evidently a special value to his mind, but are to other men the counters of an unknown coinage. To them, they seem merely so much brass or copper or tarnished silver at the best. At other times, the beauty of the thought was obscured by careless writing, as though he had suddenly doubted if writing was not a foolish labor. He had frequently illustrated his verses with drawings, in which an imperfect anatomy did not altogether hide extreme beauty of feeling. The fairies, in whom he believes, have given him many subjects, notably Thomas of Ercildoune, sitting motionless in the twilight while a young and beautiful creature leans softly out of the shadow and whispers in his ear. He had delighted above all in strong effects of color, spirits who have upon their heads, instead of hair, the feathers of peacocks, a phantom reaching from a swirl of flame towards a star, a spirit passing with a globe of iridescent crystal, symbol of the soul, half shut within his hand. But always under this largesse of color lay some tender homily addressed to man's fragile hopes. This spiritual eagerness draws to him all those who, like himself, seek for illumination or else mourn for a joy that has gone. One of these especially comes to mind. A winter or two ago, he spent much of the night walking up and down upon the mountain talking to an old peasant who, dumb to most men, poured out his cares for him. Both were unhappy. Xavier, because he had then first decided that art and poetry were not for him, and the old peasant because his life was ebbing out with no achievement remaining and no hope left him. Both how Celtic, how full of striving after a something never to be completely expressed in word or deed. The peasant was wandering in his mind with prolonged sorrow. Once he burst out with, "God possesses the heavens, God possesses the heavens, but he covets the world." And once he lamented that his old neighbors were gone and that all had forgotten him. They used to draw a chair to the fire for him in every cabin, and now they said, "Who is that old fellow there?" "The fret," Irish for doom, "is over me," he repeated, and then went on to talk once more of God and heaven. More than once also he said, waving his arm toward the mountain, "Only myself knows what happened under the thorn tree 40 years ago." And as he said it, the tears upon his face glistened in the moonlight. This old man always rises before me when I think of Xavier. Both seek, one in wandering sentences, the other in symbolic pictures and subtle allegoric poetry, to express a something that lies beyond the range of expression. And both, if Xavier will forgive me, have within them the vast and vague extravagance that lies at the bottom of the Celtic heart. The peasant visionaries that are, the landlord duelists that were, and the whole hurly-burly of legends. Cuchulainn fighting the sea for 2 days until the waves pass over him and he dies. Quilcha storming the palace of the gods. Oisin seeking in vain for 300 years to appease his insatiable heart with all the pleasures of fairyland. These two mystics walking up and down upon the mountains, uttering the central dreams of their souls in no less dream-laden sentences, and this mind that finds them so interesting, all are a portion of that great Celtic phantasmagoria whose meaning no man has discovered, nor any angel revealed. Village ghosts. In the great cities, we see so little of the world. We drift into our minority. In the little towns and villages, there are no minorities. People are not numerous enough. You must see the world there, perforce. Every man is himself a class. Every hour carries its new challenge. When you pass the inn at the end of the village, you leave your favorite whimsy behind you, for you will meet no one who can share it. We listen to eloquent speaking, read books, and write them, settle all the affairs of the universe. The dumb village multitudes pass on unchanging. The feel of the spade in the hand is no different for all our talk. Good seasons and bad follow each other as of old. The dumb multitudes are no more concerned with us than is the old horse peering through the rusty gate of the village pound. The ancient mapmakers wrote across unexplored regions, "Here are lions." Across the villages of fishermen and turners of the earth, so different are these from us, we can write but one line that is certain. Here are ghosts. My ghosts inhabit the village of H in Leinster. History has in no manner been burdened by this ancient village with its crooked lanes, its old abbey churchyard full of long grass, its green background of small fir trees, and its quay, where lie a few tarry fishing luggers. In the annals of entomology, it is well known, for a small bay lies westward a little, where he who watches night after night may see a certain rare moth fluttering along the edge of the tide, just at the end of evening or the beginning of dawn. 100 years ago, it was carried here from Italy by smugglers in a cargo of silks and laces. If the moth hunter would throw down his net and go hunting for ghost tales or tales of the fairies and such like children of Lilith, he would have need for far less patience. To approach the village at night, a timid man requires great strategy. A man was once heard complaining, "By the cross of Jesus, how shall I go? If I pass by the hill of Dunboy, old Captain Burney may look out on me. If I go round by the water and up by the steps, there is the headless one and another one on the quays and a new one under the old churchyard wall. If I go right round the other way, Mrs. Stewart is appearing at Hillside Gate, and the devil himself is in the hospital lane." I never heard which spirit he braved, but feel sure it was not the one in the hospital lane. In cholera times, a shed had been there set up to receive patients. When the need had gone by, it was pulled down. But ever since, the ground where it stood has broken out in ghosts and demons and fairies. There is a farmer at H, Paddy B by name, a man of great strength and a teetotaler. His wife and sister-in-law, musing on his great strength, often wonder what he would do if he drank. One night, when passing through the hospital lane, he saw what he supposed at first to be a tame rabbit. After a little, he found that it was a white cat. When he came near, the creature slowly began to swell larger and larger, and as it grew, he felt his own strength ebbing away, as though it were sucked out of him. He turned and ran. By the hospital lane goes the fairy's path. Every evening, they travel from the hill to the sea, from the sea to the hill. At the sea end of their path stands a cottage. One night, Mrs. Arbunathy, who lived there, left her door open as she was expecting her son. Her husband was asleep by the fire. A tall man came in and sat beside him. After he had been sitting there for a while, the woman said, "In the name of God, who are you?" He got up and went out, saying, "Never leave the door open at this hour, or evil may come to you." She woke her husband and told him, "One of the good people has been with us," said he. Probably the man braved Mrs. Stewart at Hillside Gate. When she lived, she was the wife of the Protestant clergyman. Her ghost was never known to harm anyone, say the village people. It is only doing a penance upon the earth. Not far from Hillside Gate, where she haunted, appeared for a short time a much more remarkable spirit. Its haunt was the Bogeen, a green lane leading from the western end of the village. I quote its history at length. A typical village tragedy. In a cottage at the village end of the Bogeen, lived a house painter, Jim Montgomery, and his wife. They had several children. He was a little dandy and came of a higher class than his neighbors. His wife was a very big woman. Her husband, who had been expelled from the village choir for drink, gave her a beating one day. Her sister heard of it and came and took down one of the window shutters. Montgomery was neat about everything and had shutters on the outside of every window, and beat him with it, being big and strong like her sister. Her sister heard of it and came and took down one of the window shutters. Montgomery was neat about everything and had shutters on the outside of every window, and beat him with it, being big and strong like her sister. He threatened to prosecute her. She answered that she would break every bone in his body if he did. She never spoke to her sister again because she had allowed herself to be beaten by so small a man. Jim Montgomery grew worse and worse, his wife soon began to have not enough to eat. She told no one, for she was very proud. Often, too, she would have no fire on a cold night. If any neighbors came in, she would say she had let the fire out because she was just going to bed. The people about often heard her husband beating her, but she never told anyone. She got very thin. At last, one Saturday, there was no food in the house for herself and the children. She could bear it no longer and went to the priest and asked him for some money. He gave her 30 shillings. Her husband met her and took the money and beat her. On the following Monday, she got very ill and sent for a Mrs. Kelly. Mrs. Kelly, as soon as she saw her, said, "My woman, you are dying," and sent for the priest and the doctor. She died in an hour. After her death, as Montgomery neglected the children, the landlord had them taken to the workhouse. A few nights after they had gone, Mrs. Kelly was going home through the Beguine when the ghost of Mrs. Montgomery appeared and followed her. It did not leave her until she reached her own house. She told the priest, Father S., a noted antiquarian, and could not get him to believe her. A few nights afterwards, Mrs. Kelly again met the spirit in the same place. She was in too great terror to go the whole way, but stopped at a neighbor's cottage midway and asked them to let her in. They answered they were going to bed. She cried out, "In the name of God, let me in, or I will break open the door." They opened, and so she escaped from the ghost. Next day, she told the priest again. This time he believed and said it would follow her until she spoke to it. She met the spirit a third time in the Beguine. She asked what kept it from its rest. The spirit said that its children must be taken from the workhouse, for none of its relations were ever there before, and that three masses were to be said for the repose of its soul. "If my husband does not believe you," she said, "show him that," and touched Mrs. Kelly's wrist with three fingers. The places where they touched swelled up and blackened. She then vanished. For a time, Montgomery would not believe that his wife had appeared. She would not show herself to Mrs. Kelly, he said, she with respectable people to appear to. He was convinced by the three marks, and the children were taken from the workhouse. The priest said the masses, and the shade must have been at rest, for it has not since appeared. Sometime afterwards, Jim Montgomery died in the workhouse, having come to great poverty through drink. I know some who believe they have seen the headless ghost upon the quay, and one who, when he passes the old cemetery wall at night, sees a woman with white borders to her cap creep out and follow him. The apparition only leaves him at his own door. The villagers imagine that she follows him to avenge some wrong. "I will haunt you when I die," is a favorite threat. His wife was once half scared to death by what she considers a demon in the shape of a dog. These are a few of the open-air spirits. The more domestic of their tribe gather within doors, plentiful as swallows under southern eaves. One night, a Mrs. Nolan was watching by her dying child in Floody's Lane. Suddenly, there was a sound of knocking heard at the door. She did not open, fearing it was some unhuman thing that knocked. The knocking ceased. After a little, the front door and then the back door were burst open and closed again. Her husband went to see what was wrong. He found both doors bolted. The child died. The doors were again opened and closed as before. Then Mrs. Nolan remembered that she had forgotten to leave window or door open, as the custom is for the departure of the soul. These strange openings and closings and knockings were warnings and reminders from the spirits who attend the dying. The house ghost is usually a harmless and well-meaning creature. It is put up with as long as possible. It brings good luck to those who live with it. I remember two children who slept with their mother and sisters and brothers in one small room. In the room was also a ghost. They sold herrings in the Dublin streets and did not mind the ghost much, because they knew they would always sell their fish easily while they slept in the haunted room. I have some acquaintance among the ghost seers of Western villages. The Connaught tales are very different from those of Leinster. These H spirits have a gloomy, matter-of-fact way with them. They come to announce a death, to fulfill some obligation, to revenge a wrong, to pay their bills even, as did a fisherman's daughter the other day, and then hasten to their rest. All things they do decently and in order. It is demons and not ghosts that transform themselves into white cats or black dogs. The people who tell the tales are poor, serious-minded fishing people who find in the doings of the ghosts the fascination of fear. In the Western tales, it is a whimsical grace, a curious extravagance. The people who recount them live in the most wild and beautiful scenery, under a sky ever loaded and fantastic with flying clouds. They are farmers and laborers who do a little fishing now and then. They do not fear the spirits too much to feel an artistic and humorous pleasure in their doings. The ghosts themselves share in their quaint hilarity. In one Western town, on whose deserted wharf the grass grows, these spirits have so much vigor that, when a misbeliever ventured to sleep in a haunted house, I have been told they flung him through the window and his bed after him. In the surrounding villages, the creatures use the most strange disguises. A dead old gentleman robs the cabbages of his own garden in the shape of a large rabbit. A wicked sea captain stayed for years inside the plaster of a cottage wall in the shape of a snipe, making the most horrible noises. He was only dislodged when the wall was broken down. Then, out of the solid plaster, the snipe rushed away whistling. Dust hath closed Helen's eye. I have been lately to a little group of houses, not many enough to be called a village, in the barony of Kiltartan in County Galway, whose name, Ballylee, is known through all the west of Ireland. There is the old square castle, Ballylee, inhabited by a farmer and his wife, and a cottage where their daughter and their son-in-law live, and a little mill with an old miller, and old ash trees throwing green shadows upon a little river and great stepping stones. I went there two or three times last year to talk to the miller about Biddy Early, a wise woman that lived in Clare some years ago, and about her saying, there is a cure for all evil between the two mill wheels of Ballylee, and to find out from him or another whether she meant the moss between the running waters or some other herb. I've been there this summer, and I shall be there again before it is autumn, because Mary Hines, a beautiful woman whose name is still a wonder by turf fires, died there 60 years ago. For our feet would linger where beauty has lived its life of sorrow to make us understand that it is not of the world. An old man brought me a little way from the mill and the castle and down a long, narrow boreen that was nearly lost in brambles and sloe bushes, and he said, that is the little old foundation of the house, but the most of it is taken for building walls, and the goats have ate those bushes that are growing over it till they've got cranky, and they won't grow anymore. They say she was the handsomest girl in Ireland. Her skin was like dribbled snow. He meant driven snow, perhaps. And she had blushes in her cheeks. She had five handsome brothers, but all are gone now. I talked to him about a poem in Irish, Raftery, a famous poet, made about her, and how it said, there is a strong cellar in Ballylee. He said the strong cellar was the great hole where the river sank underground, and he brought me to a deep pool where an otter hurried away under a gray boulder and told me that many fish came up out of the dark water at early morning to taste the fresh water coming down from the hills. I first heard of the poem from an old woman who lives about 2 miles further up the river and who remembers Raftery and Mary Hines. She says, I never saw anybody so handsome as she was, and I never will till I die. And that he was nearly blind and had no way of living but to go round and to mark some house to go to, and then all the neighbors would gather to hear. If you treated him well, he'd praise you, but if you did not, he'd fault you in Irish. He was the greatest poet in Ireland, and he'd make a song about that bush if he chanced to stand under it. There was a bush he stood under from the rain, and he made verses praising it. And then when the water came through, he made verses dispraising it. She sang the poem to a friend and to myself in Irish. And every word was audible and expressive, as the words in a song were always, as I think, before music grew too proud to be the garment of words, flowing and changing with the flowing and changing of their energies. The poem is not as natural as the best Irish poetry of the last century, for the thoughts are arranged in a too obviously traditional form. So the old, poor, half-blind man who made it has to speak as if he were a rich farmer offering the best of everything to the woman he loves, but it has naive and tender phrases. The friend that was with me has made some of the translation, but some of it has been made by the country people themselves. I think it has more of the simplicity of the Irish verses than one finds in most translations. Going to Mass by the will of God, the day came wet and the wind rose. I met Mary Hines at the cross of Kiltartan, and I fell in love with her then and there. I spoke to her kind and mannerly, as by report was her own way. And she said, "Raftery, my mind is easy. You may come today to Ballylee." When I heard her offer, I did not linger. When her talk went to my heart rose. We had only to go across the three fields. We had daylight with us to Ballylee. The table was laid with glasses and a quart measure. She had fair hair, and she sitting beside me. And she said, "Drink, Raftery, and 100 welcomes. There is a strong cellar in Ballylee. O star of light, and O sun in harvest, O amber hair, O my share of the world, will you come with me upon Sunday till we agree together before all the people? I would not grudge you a song every Sunday evening, punch on the table, or wine if you would drink it. But, O King of glory, dry the roads before me till I find the way to Ballylee. There is sweet air on the side of the hill when you are looking down upon Ballylee. When you are walking in the valley picking nuts and blackberries, there is music of the birds in it and music of the she. What is the worth of greatness till you have the light of the flower of the branch that is by your side? There is no God to deny it or try to hide it. She is the sun in the heavens who wounded my heart. There was no part of Ireland I did not travel, from the rivers to the tops of the mountains, to the edge of Loch Grainne, whose mouth is hidden, and I saw no beauty but was behind hers. Her hair was shining, and her brows were shining too. Her face was like herself, her mouth pleasant and sweet. She is the pride, and I give her the branch. She is the shining flower of Ballylee. It is Mary Hines, the calm and easy woman, has beauty in her mind and in her face. If 100 clerks were gathered together, they could not write down a half of her ways. An old weaver whose son is supposed to go away among the she, the fairies, at night says, "Mary Hines was the most beautiful thing ever made. My mother used to tell me about her, for she'd be at every hurling, and wherever she was dressed in white. As many as 11 men asked her in marriage in one day, but she wouldn't have any of them. There was a lot of men up behind Kilbecanty one night sitting together drinking and talking of her, and one of them got up and set out to go to Ballylee and see her. But Clun Bog was open then, and when he came to it, he fell into the water and they found him dead there in the morning. She died of the fever that was before the famine. Another old man says he was only a child when he saw her, but he remembered that the strongest man that was among us, one John Madden, got his death of the head of her. Cold he got crossing rivers in the nighttime to go to Ballylee. This is perhaps the man the other remembered, for tradition gives the one thing many shapes. There is an old woman who remembers her at Derry Bryan among the Aechtga Hills, a vast desolate place which has changed little since the old poem said, 'The stag upon the cold summit of Aechtga hears the cry of the wolves,' but still mindful of many poems and of the dignity of ancient speech. She says, 'The sun and the moon never shone on anybody so handsome, and her skin was so white that it looked blue, and she had 2 little blushes on her cheeks.' And an old wrinkled woman who lives close by Ballylee and has told me many tales of the she says, 'I often saw Mary Hines. She was handsome indeed. She had 2 bunches of curls beside her cheeks, and they were the color of silver. I saw Mary Malloy that was drowned in the river beyond, and Mary Guthrie that was in Ardrahan, but she took the sway of them both, a very comely creature. I was at her wake, too. She had seen too much of the world. She was a kind creature. One day I was coming home through that field beyond, and I was tired. And who should come out but the poison glaegill, the shining flower, and she gave me a glass of new milk. This old woman meant no more than some beautiful bright color by the color of silver, for though I knew an old man, he is dead now, who thought she might know the cure for all the evils in the world, that the she knew, she has seen too little gold to know its color. But a man by the shore of Kinvara, who is too young to remember Mary Hines, says, 'Everybody says there is no one at all to be seen now so handsome. It is said she had beautiful hair, the color of gold. She was poor, but her clothes every day were the same as Sunday. She had such neatness. And if she went to any kind of a meeting, they would all be killing one another for a sight of her. And there was a great many in love with her, but she died young. It is said that no one that has a song made about them will ever live long. Those who are much admired are, it is held, taken by the she who can use ungoverned feeling for their own ends, so that a father, as an old herb doctor told me once, may give his child into their hands or a husband his wife. The admired and desired are only safe if one says, God bless them, when one's eyes are upon them. The old woman that sang the song thinks too that Mary Hines was taken, as the phrase is, for they have taken many that are not handsome, and why would they not take her? And people came from all parts to look at her, and maybe there were some that did not say, God bless her. An old man who lives by the sea at Duras has as little doubt that she was taken, for there are some living yet can remember her coming to the pattern there beyond, and she was said to be the handsomest girl in Ireland. She died young because the gods loved her, for the she are the gods, and it may be that the old saying, which we forget to understand literally, meant her manner of death in old times. These poor countrymen and countrywomen in their beliefs and in their emotions are many years nearer to that old Greek world that set beauty beside the fountain of things than are our men of learning. She had seen too much of the world. But these old men and women, when they tell of her, blame another and not her. And though they can be hard, they grow gentle as the old men of Troy grew gentle when Helen passed by on the walls. The poet who helped her to so much fame has himself a great fame throughout the west of Ireland. Some think that Raftery was half blind and say, I saw Raftery, a dark man, but he had sight enough to see her or the like. But some think he was wholly blind, as he may have been at the end of his life. Fable makes all things perfect in their kind, and her blind people must never look on the world and the sun. I asked a man I met one day when I was looking for a pool, Numnoshi, where women of faery have been seen, how Raftery could have admired Mary Hines so much if he had been altogether blind. He said, I think Raftery was altogether blind. But those that are blind have a way of seeing things and have the power to know more and to feel more and to do more and to guess more than those that have their sight. And a certain wit and a certain wisdom is given to them. Everybody, indeed, will tell you that he was very wise, for was he not only blind but a poet? The weaver whose words about Mary Hines I have already given says, his poetry was the gift of the Almighty. For there are three things that are the gift of the Almighty, poetry and dancing and principles. That is why in the old times, an ignorant man coming down from the hillside would be better behaved and have better learning than a man with education you'd meet now, for they got it from God. And a man at Cool says, when he put his finger to one part of his head, everything will come to him as if it was written in a book. And an old pensioner at Kiltartan says, he was standing under a bush one time, and he talked to it, and it answered him back in Irish. Some say it was the bush that spoke, but it must have been an enchanted voice in it, and it gave him the knowledge of all the things of the world. The bush withered up afterwards, and it is to be seen on the roadside now between this and Rahasin. There is a poem of his about a bush which I have never seen, and it may have come out of the cauldron of fable in this shape. A friend of mine met a man once who had been with him when he died, but the people say that he died alone. And one Mortine Galane told Dr. Hyde that all night long a light was seen streaming up to heaven from the roof of the house where he lay, and that was the angels who were with him. And all night long there was a great light in the hovel, and that was the angels who were waking him. They gave that honor to him because he was so good a poet and sang such religious songs. It may be that in a few years, Fable, who changes mortalities to immortalities in her cauldron, will have changed Mary Hines and Raftery to perfect symbols of the sorrow of beauty and of the magnificence and penury of dreams. When I was in a northern town a while ago, I had a long talk with a man who had lived in a neighboring country district when he was a boy. He told me that when a very beautiful girl was born in a family that had not been noted for good looks, her beauty was thought to have come from the she, and to bring misfortune with it. He went over the names of several beautiful girls that he had known and said that beauty had never brought happiness to anybody. It was a thing he said to be proud of and afraid of. I wish I had written out his words at the time, for they were more picturesque than my memory of them.
Thank you for listening to this sample. To continue listening to this book and for access to all of our other full audiobooks, please subscribe for $7.77 per month. Go to adultbrain.ca or follow the link in the show notes. This will be a completely separate podcast with a new RSS feed and will have all the titles from this feed as well. Thank you for your help and support in bringing rare and forgotten books to audio for the world.